Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions, with support from the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky and the Appalachian Impact Fund, working together to promote community collaboration, economic development, and education by increasing charitable giving and philanthropic investments across communities in southeastern Kentucky. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. Elaine McMillian Sheldon is the director of two Netflix original documentaries, Heroin, with an E, and Recovery Boys.
She did overdose in the bathroom.
4773
Logan Street,
there off Darnell. 23-year-old female.
She's dead. Overdose. It's in Barbersville, Talbot County.
The films explore America's opioid crisis. Heroin was nominated for a 2018 Academy Award and won the 2018 Emmy Award for Outstanding Short Documentary. Elaine has been commissioned by Netflix, Frontline PBS, the Center for Investigative Reporting, the New York Times OpDocs, TED Women, Field of Vision, and The Bitter Southerner, and she's appeared on The Daily Show with Trevor Noah and Meet the Press with Chuck Todd. And Elaine will be on campus here at Eastern Kentucky University on February 27th as guest speaker in the university's Chautauqua Lecture Series. We caught up with her in Charleston. Elaine, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So briefly, some background on you first, if we could. Where is home? I know you're in Charleston. Is that home for you? And how did you get into making documentaries?
Sure. Yes, Charleston is home now, but my childhood was mostly spent in Logan, West Virginia, near the Kentucky border. And I got into storytelling. I was a very curious kid, and actually it started with journalism, seeing my local newspaper and the local journalist being a part of the community. I just felt like that was a great role for someone who was somewhat of a nosy kid, a curious kid that liked telling stories. And so I pursued journalism initially, attending West Virginia University. So that's how it all started.
We often hear from people in our region talking about a new narrative for Appalachia. Were you drawn to that idea as well?
I think so. I think that I was definitely one of those Appalachians that saw the disparities between the images that were representing Appalachia on the national news and national platforms and how different that was from my own community. Sure, the region has a lot of problems and a lot of challenges to overcome, but what I was seeing in my own community and what I continue to see and why I continue to live in West Virginia and in Appalachia is because there's just so much more going on beneath the surface. There's so many resilient people that are trying to make change, and they're often so overlooked by parachute journalists that come in. So, you know, it was a counter narrative that I was trying to go up against. And I think, you know, trying to find resilience and joy and hope and all the things that we hold that can often get lost in sort of the black and white depictions of us.
Well, an article in the New York Times that I read about you says that at first you really kind of struggled with the thought of documenting the Appalachian opioid epidemic. What was behind that reluctance?
I just felt like I didn't know how I could add to the conversation. It still is a very daunting conversation. It's one in which I've lost friends from high school and middle school, and I felt overwhelmed by it. And the majority of the images I was seeing come out of the crisis were those of either drug use or destruction. And I'm not a person that wants to solely create images that I feel like aren't helping in some way, that aren't moving the narrative forward or sort of giving us a different picture of something that we think we've seen enough of. And so I was reluctant because I didn't want to make more of the same. I didn't want to add to the destructive imagery that was coming out. And it wasn't until we were able to find some incredible people on the ground, you know, in the case of Recovery Boys, a doctor who was starting a rehab in light of his own son's addiction, as well as these three women in Huntington, West Virginia that get up every single day and help people who are suffering, that I realized there's a way into this story that I can contribute that shows strong individuals making change. So the reluctancy went away once my faith was put in these people that, get up every day and do what they can to improve their corner of the world.
In the short documentary, Heroine, you actually take the viewer along for the ride with first responders, with caseworkers. It's sad, but in the end, it's also uplifting. Is that what you were going for?
Yeah, I mean, there's such a breath to life that we don't often see. I mean, so often, especially journalists that are on such time constraints, they can't show the full story. They can't wait around and see both Jan Rader, who's in the film, responding to an overdose, and her being in a moment where, you know, she's having a quiet moment with the men at the fire station. There's not a balance of imagery. It's all of one. It's either Appalachia's all bad and Appalachia's poor and Appalachia's unhealthy and it's all bad, which we know. Those of us who live here know there's always something else. And the two polar opposites, you know, the joy and the sadness, just the fact that they exist is something to be documented. And just the fact that they exist doesn't negate that the other one exists. I think there's this idea that, you know, nobody wants to wear rose-colored glasses and pretend we don't have problems. But I think a more realistic portrayal is one that shows both the ups and downs. Because if it was all bad, we'd all leave. You know, there's something keeping all of us here.
I believe your next release coming up is the film Tutwiler, which is a collaboration with the Marshall Project and PBS Frontline. What's that about?
So Tutwiler is a film that we spent over a year making, where we followed some women inside of a prison in Alabama, the Julia Tutwiler Prison for Women, who are incarcerated while pregnant. And so we followed women that are participating in the doula program, which provides them pregnancy education and support during birth, as the women only have 24 hours with their babies before they have to return. Yeah, I'm looking forward to that, and it will have a broadcast date later this year.
Okay, and that'll be broadcast as a Frontline presentation?
Yes.
Okay, well, congratulations on that as well. Documentary filmmaker Elaine McMillian Sheldon. Elaine will be on the EKU campus on February 27th as guest speaker in the university's Chautauqua Lecture Series. More information on that at chautauqua.eku.edu. If you're driving, don't write that down. We'll post a link on the facts and information page of our site, eswku.org. Thanks for joining us, Elaine.
Thank you for having me.
The Kentucky Local Food Systems Summit is coming up at the University of Kentucky, and here to tell us about this second annual gathering of people working in the local food industry in a wide variety of capacities are Dr. Lillian Brislin, Executive Director of the Food Connection and Applied Academic Center at UK, and Ashton Wright, who's Food Coordinator for the City of Lexington. Thank you both for coming in.
Thanks so much for having us.
This will be year two for the annual Kentucky Local Food Systems Summit. And do I understand correctly that this is a partnership between UK, the City of Lexington, and the Kentucky Department of Agriculture?
That's exactly correct. All of this work of local food systems comes through collaboration and partnership.
I know that you're going to be showcasing some local programs that you would like to see replicated across the state. Can you tell us about those?
Folks who come to the summit can hear about farmers market innovations, so like the Kentucky Double Dollars program, Fresh RX for Moms program, the emergence of community cafes, all the way to value-added meat processing and produce processing. There's going to be a really wide variety of topics addressed at the summit.
You know, I think when we hear the term local food, the mind tends to go straight to farmers markets, to maybe restaurants that offer locally sourced fare on their menus. But is that perception of local food systems too narrow?
It's a great starting point. We've seen incredible success with farmers markets. People love to go and meet their farmers. In Lexington alone, we'd estimate that almost $3 million worth of sales happened at our farmers markets here in the city. So it's big business for Kentucky, and we want to keep that good thing growing, if you'll forgive the pun. So how do we use the example set by the University of Kentucky? We have an annual commitment to purchasing local foods, which includes a farm impact specific commitment. So last year, UK bought $1.3 million worth of products that could some way be traced back to a Kentucky farm. So how do we keep moving that needle, looking at hospitals, looking at public schools? And Ashton and her colleagues have done some incredible work around a CSA voucher program through the Kentucky Farm Share Coalition that's impacting lots of Kentucky families and farmers.
Yeah, I want to talk about the CSAs in just a second, but to expand on that, I understand that there are some other good examples of how this has reached the institutional level, such as with the Lexington Center, Transylvania. I'm not sure that people really know that there's a local food connection with those big institutions.
Yeah, we recently hosted a group of national leaders around farmed institution purchasing, farm to campus, farm to hospital. And these folks came from both coasts. They came from big and small institutions. USDA representatives were there. And it was incredible to show them what we're doing on the UK campus around our salad bar program, where we have 10 different farmers supplying salad bar items year round, our whole animal program, where we supply all of the muscle meats and hamburgers in our residential dining are coming from Kentucky farms. And they said, "We just never knew that this was happening in Kentucky." And we've really set the gold standard when it comes to farm-to-campus procurement. And we want to share those examples and help leverage the systems that we've built for our campus to get those products flowing to our other institutions, which is, again, why this collaborative work and talking across our communities and across our institutions helps us share ideas and best practices and leverage our strength in numbers to move more product into it, which is why the new convention center is going to be an incredible opportunity.
Just to add on to that, I think that contractual obligations like the one seen at the university is the gold standard, but it can be used as a model. And that's what we did with in partnership with the LCC board when they engaged in their new contract with Levy, their food service partner. And so we said, look what the great work that UK is doing. They have a contractual commitment to help support Kentucky growers. You all should too. And they fortunately agreed. So I think that that's going to have a big impact on Kentucky producers once the construction's completed.
Ashton, we were about to get into CSA's Community-Supported Agriculture and the Kentucky Farm Share Coalition. Can you pick up on that and tell us what's happening in that area?
Sure. So the Kentucky Farm Share Coalition is a collaborative effort that is spearheaded by the Organic Association of Kentucky. The city of Lexington participates as a workplace employer. The University of Kentucky also is a big participant in this program. And so basically, a CSA, as you know, is a weekly delivery of fresh local produce from a local farm. And the coalition really works with employers to incentivize the purchase of CSA shares among their employees. So the city's been offering that for about 4 years. UK has been doing it for a little bit longer. And it's a really great way to not only provide a great product for your employee, a great health benefit, but we also have research from our colleagues at UK that suggests that folks who participate in CSA are going to the doctor less and spending less on prescription medications, which is really significant.
Back to you, Lillian, back to the summit. What kinds of cross-pollinations happen? I know there are lots of people there, lots of networking going on, lots of ideas being traded and so forth. What have you seen come out of it in that regard?
Great question. Last year, our summit happened to fall on the same day as the On the Table conversations. And so we hosted one session that was just an open question about what's happening in farm markets and how do we grow those. And in the room happened to be folks from Marksbury Farms and the Cattlemen's Association and some other cattle producers who were trying to answer the question for themselves, how do we access local food markets for our beef? And that's a broad diversity of types of cattle producers and types of cattle markets. And through that open conversation, we realized that there were a lot of shared opportunities and shared challenges in the local beef sphere. So this year, we're having a session dedicated to just that question of what's happening with local beef in Kentucky. So asking and answering questions about who's your market? What stories do you tell about your beef? How do we come together to look at infrastructure like processing or transportation or certifications that would help us grow opportunities for all of our many cattle producers?
This is at the University of Kentucky, so obviously it's a learning experience. How do students get involved and engaged in what's going on at the summit?
We offer an annual grant program called our Student Opportunity Grants that supports programming or research or exciting learning opportunities related to food systems. So we've invited those grant recipients to tell us about what they've done. We have 15 different poster presentations happening, so students and their faculty mentors will be there to talk about their work. One piece of that that I'm excited about is Dr. Tammy Stevenson is bringing a veggie meter, which I don't know what sort of scientific magic is behind it, but it will look at your skin and tell you if you've been eating your veggies, which you should know. But maybe
quite
sometimes
an expensive machine.
Yeah, we don't always tell ourselves the truth. So come get your veggie skin tested.
Well, I can see that right by the blood pressure machine in your pharmacy or your grocery store.
Yeah. We'll also have a demonstration around an approachable loaf program. So our friends at Bluegrass Baking, along with Dr. Dave Van Sanford, are going to be doing some taste testing and sampling around breads made from 100% Kentucky-grown grains. And students will be participating all through the day. So we've had some scholarships made available through the Student Sustainability Council to make sure students can access and build their own professional networks and get new minds into this work of local food systems.
And I also think, too, for them to see the breadth of local food systems practitioners is really important. And in going into, you know, they may not realize that some of these jobs exist. So I think that's a really important component as well.
Dr. Lillian Brislin, Executive Director of the Food Connection and Applied Academic Center at UK, and Ashton Wright, Food Coordinator for the City of Lexington. Thank you both for coming in.
It's been such a pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Coming up after the break, our 19th Amendment series and the results of a survey on the policy priorities of American women, and another on women in food and farming. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Support for WEKU and Eastern Standard comes from Hicks & Funson. Kentucky lawyers Greg Funson, Kenny Heumann, Kayla Combs, and Shannon Church provide legal representation for auto accidents, medical malpractice, elder care, and immigration law. More information at 859-777-7000.
Do you have a news tip, a comment, or a question for Eastern Standard? Leave a message at 859-622-WEKU. It could be used in a future show. Would you like to listen again to this Eastern Standard or other past episodes? You can find them online at weku.fm or the WEKU mobile app. Now back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
EKU history professor Jackie Jay is here with the second installment of our monthly series about the centennial of ratification of the 19th Amendment establishing women's right to vote.
Over the next few months, we're going to be looking at historical developments in the 19th century leading up to that significant moment. And today, I'm joined by one of my colleagues in EKU's Department of History, Philosophy, and Religious Studies, Dr. Josh Lynn. Josh is a specialist in American political thought and political culture in the 19th century, and we've asked him here today to talk about the very notions of constitutional rights and citizenship. Today, we take for granted the fact that citizenship serves as the basis for an individual's right to vote. But it hasn't always been that way. So, Josh, I'd like to start by asking you to describe for us how people thought about rights and citizenship in early America. Where did rights actually come from?
Yeah, thanks, Jackie. Yeah, you have it right. We often assume today that citizenship comes with all this bundle of rights, and that a citizen has all the rights. And one of those rights is the right to vote, is suffrage. But like you said, in the 19th century, there was a very different conception of both citizenship and rights. So there was no nationally defined notion of citizenship in the 19th century or before the Civil War. The states themselves defined citizens, not the federal government for the most part. And the rights that came with citizenship thus varied by state. Individuals could be citizens and not have certain rights that other people who were not citizens did have. And so there was no necessary correlation between the status of citizen and a set list of rights that that citizen had. And a great example of that is white women were citizens, but in many states could not vote, while some white men who were not citizens could vote. And that would be, for example, white men who were immigrants not yet naturalized. So there was no strict correlation of citizenship, rights, and suffrage. And rights, duties, privileges, obligations to the government varied not just by state, but even by locality. So there's really sort of a haphazard patchwork in the early American Republic through the Civil War of status. People could have a variety of different statuses based on their position in society. And those rights, there was no right that translated across the entire country necessarily.
So there's a broad difference, and
different localities, as you say, determine rights differently, and it's not tied to citizenship, the right to vote. So then who did have rights, and specifically who had the right to vote, and was voting even considered to be a right? You've mentioned white men versus women. How does that play into it?
So even though there was this heady rhetoric of natural rights coming out of the American Revolution, there was no notion that anybody inherently had a right to vote in the late 18th century and into the early 19th century. But gradually, suffrage was expanded dramatically in the first decades of the 19th century, so that by the time of the Civil War, all white men in almost every state had the right to vote regardless of their class status, regardless of their taxpayer status or their property holding status. So what does emerge is a notion that there's at least one group in society that does have a natural right to vote, and that is white men. But that can still be regardless of citizenship. And the politicians who really put forth this idea that, yes, there is a natural right to vote on some part of the population, white men, was the party of Andrew Jackson, the Democratic Party, really embraced this idea that there is a natural correlation between status and voting rights, not citizenship status and voting rights, but the status of white and male. And that status brought with it a natural right to vote. So once again, you still have a situation where white men who were not even citizens could often vote, because Democrats especially would enfranchise them before they had attained citizenship status if they were white men who were immigrants. And so by the time of the Civil War, most states had full white manhood suffrage, and all but South Carolina had popular election in presidential elections. So it's quite a expansive notion of democracy for white men. It's the most democratic polity in human history up until that point. At the same time, what emerges as a corollary to this idea that these white men had a natural right to vote was that some people naturally did not have a right to vote.
Ah, so that's fascinating that white men, even without citizenship, were the ones who considered themselves the proper voting parties in the United States. So then as other groups, the disenfranchised groups, women, white women, and then black people in general, were fighting for the right to vote, how did they position themselves against that?
This notion that white men had a natural right to vote had a certain bundle of rights that came with their status of their race and gender was not held by everybody, obviously, in the antebellum United States. So that this was a contested notion, although for much of the antebellum era, this was the Jacksonian Democrats were a leading force in politics in defining what rights were. But there were other ways to define rights. But what you do have is a situation where white men's rights develop and the franchise is expanded for white men, usually simultaneously with the restriction of rights for others. So in states that did have voting rights for African-American men, in the few places where women could vote, what you often had occurring with white male enfranchisement or the expansion of their franchise was simultaneously disenfranchisement of black men and women or the imposition of property qualifications for black voting. And these are not coincidental. They are actually mutually reinforcing processes. And there was always opposition to that, often from other political parties. White politicians could oppose this, but most obviously African Americans themselves, women themselves, especially in the early women's suffrage movement of the mid-19th century.
So when we think of black people gaining the right to vote, black men, that would come post the Civil War, before the Jim Crow era. And so they had the right to vote, but then that was gradually infringed upon whether they could actually exercise that right. But the notion that there were women in certain states, and you're speaking of before the 19th Amendment, that there were certain states where women could vote, and then that right was taken away, as was that a federal movement from the Democratic Party?
So none of this was done at the federal level. All of this was done on a state-by-state basis. So what you have is a series of constitutional conventions in every state, or new states coming into the union with new constitutions prescribing suffrage requirements. And usually these constitutional conventions democratize. They both democratize state government, the amount of elected officials, how accessible government was But they also democratize the franchise for white men. But many of these constitutional conventions at the same moment disenfranchise black voters if that was a state in which African Americans could vote. And in the one notable state where women could vote, that was New Jersey, that right was also eroded for women. So these are parallel movements, white enfranchisement for all white men and black disenfranchisement on a state-by-state basis.
And so then as women are beginning to fight for suffrage, I know there are differing justifications that they are offering. If white men are saying we have the privilege to vote by virtue of the fact that we are white men, what claims can women make against that?
Right. So what you see is that because there was no consensus of where rights came from, not everyone bought into the Jacksonian Democratic argument that white men had natural rights, including the right to vote, because of their status as white men. Because not everyone bought into that, there's still a variety of ideas of where rights, where privileges come from. Sometimes voting was not even reckoned as a right. It was seen as a privilege. And because of that, there's different ideas for still who could exercise it based on what qualifications. And so sometimes people argued that suffrage should be a privilege based on your virtue or your morality. And so some female claimants to suffrage would have argued that their morally superior position as Christians, as wives, as mothers, as the guarantors of virtue in the domestic sphere entitled them to suffrage. So they would make a very gender-based argument that their status as women, as the more virtuous sex, should lead to their enfranchisement. Some took a much more gender-neutral, more feminist position that as individuals, they had the right to vote as all individuals should. They were not making an argument based on their gender or the supposed virtues inherent in their gender. And then perhaps more insidiously, some women, especially later into the 19th century after the Civil War and in the early 20th century, argued that if they were white, they should be able to vote, especially in a country that had enfranchised after the Civil War black men, that there's no excuse then to allow to have a situation where white women could not vote because their race made them superior. And of course, these are a variety of arguments for women's suffrage, but it just goes to show that the idea of rights and privileges could be based on different rationales.
Yeah, and I know that this was, as you say, a state-by-state development. And so each state had to ratify the 19th Amendment on its own. And the culture and the different attitudes in different regions of the country would impact the kind of justification and rationale for that ratification. And that's actually something we're going to be looking at with future speakers on this series. So I'm excited to dig into that deeper. So you've delved a little bit into the really wide range of notions of citizenship and voting rights. And we've talked a little bit about the justification for women to then have the vote. But why, if you were to sum it up in a nutshell, why would you say that these changing notions of citizenship and rights is so important to understand that moment in 1920 when the 19th Amendment was ratified?
It's really important to understand how one group in society has rights or privileges or duties in relation to others. So the Jacksonian idea that white men had rights by virtue of being white men was bound up with the idea that other people did not have rights by virtue of who they were. We often have this idea about how American history has unfolded in this very progressive fashion, that one group has rights and it just takes a matter of time for the next group to get those rights, and we've just gradually expanded. And the franchise is a perfect example of this. We have this one narrative of American history where every group eventually gets the franchise. The franchise just gradually expands sort of on its own. It's a force that just naturally grows with American democracy. But what's important to understand is that at different times in American history, certain groups have had the franchise because other groups did not. So there was no idea of a natural expansion just waiting for the next group to be able to be added to American democracy, because many times those who had a certain set of rights, especially voting rights, saw the extension of that right as undermining the right that they already had. And so there's no, they were not able to conceptualize an expansion of democracy. In the era of the mid-19th century, Democrats believed that they had perfected American democracy by enfranchising all white men, and that any expansion of the franchise would destroy the republic. So they had no room in their minds for any sort of progression of democracy. They'd already done it. It was over. And so understanding how the franchise actually unfolds in a very contested way, and it's not preordained that it will unfold and that more people will be enfranchised, that is why it's important to understand the inner workings of the process.
I want to take it to a personal level. My interest in the 19th Amendment is obviously shaped by the fact that I'm a woman, and you're a historian who happens to be a man. So for that half of the population who falls into that category, why do you think this is an important thing for us to be discussing in 2020?
It's important to understand, as a man looking back at American history, how men often exercised privileges and rights because others did not, and would point to their natural rights, their natural equality, in reference to what many saw as the natural inequality of others. And understanding that relationship is absolutely key. And that's why it's important to understand the relationships of gender and race in American political history. Also, patriarchy functions in really insidious ways. We all know that. But it affects everybody. Scratch the surface of patriarchy, and you realize that everybody's implicated in it, and everybody suffers from it. So this rhetoric of all white men, for example, having natural equal rights, that often was true in the political realm. All white men in Jacksonian America, Civil War era America, had the equal right to vote, had the equal right to hold office. But that right rarely translated to economic equality or social equality. So in the antebellum South, the average poor white farmer had the same political rights as the slaveholding oligarch. But at the end of the day, that wasn't real equality. And so, but the idea that they were equal and were therefore superior to all other people undermined the ability of white men in the past to build alliances with people who had similar social disabilities or economic handicaps, women in the population, African Americans, enslaved Americans especially. And so patriarchy can put forth ideas of equality among certain groups that mask true inequality that affect everybody.
Ah, fascinating. And I think that provides us with a really useful lens through which to view many current events today. So that brings us to the end of our time for the second installment of our 19th Amendment series. And we really hope you'll join us next month when we're planning a tie-in to March as Women's History Month and the events coming up at EKU.
EKU Professor of History, Jackie J. So what are the leading concerns of American women today? Well, the best way to find out is to ask. Joining us from Washington with some results of the Why Women Vote 2020 survey is Catherine Bean, Vice President of Public Policy and Advocacy at YWCA USA. Thanks for joining us, Catherine.
Thank you, Tom, for having me.
This is the Why's third national survey of American women. Can you give us the highlights of this one?
Sure. Our survey found this year that top of mind for women across various different kinds of demographic groups, whether that's race, what's called urbanicity, right? Rural, urban, and suburban women, as well as political party identification, are concerns about mass shootings and gun violence, as well as concerns about having medical expenses that are more than they can afford and access to affordable and secure health insurance. Those are their concerns. And on the flip side, they're also united on some really key policy priorities where they want legislators and policymakers to take action.
Okay, here we are in the 100th year since ratification of the 19th Amendment, as I mentioned. But your survey finds discrimination and prejudice still significant experiences for women. What do the numbers tell you about that?
Yes, unfortunately they are. What the numbers are telling us is that since we first started tracking these numbers in 2012, that there's been an increase of some 13% in the number of women who report that they are experiencing or have experienced discrimination because they're a woman. We have also seen that those numbers are even higher for specific women of color groups. the experience of racial or ethnic discrimination is even higher for women of color than their experience of gender discrimination. So they suffer the compounding impact of both gender and racial and ethnic discrimination. We also, this year for the first time, added a question to our survey asking about whether women had experienced sexual harassment at work during the last year. And we were startled to find that 1 in 10 women report having experienced sexual harassment in the workplace. And that number was twice that high. So 2 in 10 women who are under the age of 30 also report that experience. So younger women are also raising their voices and saying, hey, at work, I'm still facing moments that are super uncomfortable and threaten my economic security.
What are women saying about how those concerns are affecting their everyday lives?
I can tell you that at high levels, women are concerned about experiencing gender-based violence. So 1 in 3 women are concerned that they'll be sexually harassed at work. Almost half of women, 49%, report being worried that they'll be believed if they come forward and report sexual harassment or sexual assault. And a number of them, probably almost 4 in 10, so 38%, are concerned about whether they're going to have access to the counseling and services that they need after they've experienced domestic and sexual violence. What we're seeing in the data is that kind of walking around in life with such high levels of concern also seems to impact their economic concerns, so that women who have experienced multiple types of discrimination report economic, health, safety, and caregiving concerns at significantly higher levels than women who report that they have not experienced discrimination in their lifetime. So when you look at that really continuum, from discrimination to harassment to sexual violence and domestic violence, when women experience these things, they have continued worries about them, and that those in turn impact their economic security, their sense of safety, their health concerns as well.
The survey finds Generation Z women, 18 to 22-year-olds, have unique concerns that distinguish them from older women. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, it's fascinating. Gen Z women across the board tend to have higher levels of concern about a broad array of issues. They are particularly concerned about some of the things that happen during childbearing years, right? So Gen Z and millennial women being very concerned about having affordable and dependable childcare, being able to balance work responsibilities with the needs of their families, concerns about experiencing discrimination at work because they're pregnant or having paid leave to care for a child or a family member who's ill. Gen Z and millennial women share those and have higher intensity of concern about those issues. Where Gen Z women are really unique is that they have very intense concerns about climate change, about white nationalism, having affordable and secure health insurance for their families, and keeping themselves and their families safe from mass shootings. And here's the difference. Women across age cohorts are concerned about many of these things, but it's the intensity of concern that Gen Z women are registering that is particularly notable. So, for instance, around mass shootings, Gen Z women are 18 percentage points higher in their level of intense worry in comparison to women overall. On climate change, they are 15 percentage points higher in their intense worry about climate change than the numbers for women overall. I'd say as well that there are some economic concerns that are not surprising but notable for Gen Z women. They voice considerable concern about the cost of paying for college and repaying student loans, getting a good paying job, getting sexually harassed on the job, and being able to access counseling and other services, some of the things that we've talked about earlier in relation to sexual violence.
So, Catherine, according to this survey, what are the legislative priorities of American women? What do they want to see Congress move on?
Right. That's a great question. And we're really excited to see such strong support for some of the there's incredibly high intense support in the economic security arena for ensuring that our workplaces are free from sexual violence and harassment and discrimination, and also for strengthening equal pay laws for women. In the health arena, we see incredibly high levels of support. And by incredibly high, I mean 9 out of 10 women think that it's important for Congress and the president to act on these priorities, right? So 90% plus. Also in the health arena, on safeguarding healthcare coverage for pre-existing conditions, birth control, preventative health services, as well as expanding the availability of mental health services in schools and communities so that girls and women who experience sexual violence and trauma are able to access the support and services that they need. In the safety arena, we have 88% of women reporting that they support renewing the Violence Against Women Act, which is one of the foundational laws that gets federal resources into communities in order to combat domestic violence and also provide safety services to those who experience domestic violence. And on the caregiving front, there are 89% of women who support creating a national paid family and medical leave program.
It would seem that Hillary Clinton's vote tally back in 2016 really would put these questions about the viability of a female presidential candidate to rest. But here we are, 4 years after a woman running against Donald Trump garnered roughly 3 million more votes than he did. And still, America is questioning that viability. And there recently was some tension between Democrat candidates Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders, Senator Warren insisting, Senator Sanders denying, that he told her that a woman cannot win election against President Trump. How does that strike you all after doing all this research?
You caught me on a question that, as a 501c3, is a little bit tricky for us to weigh in on. Mm-hmm. What I would say to you, and this really links up with the effort that we're doing this year, is that it is more important than ever for women's voices to be heard in our civic engagement spaces, whether that's women voicing their opinions about the issues in their communities and the issues that our legislators and governors and presidents should be addressing, whether it's running for office or supporting others who run for office. Women are really powerful advocates on the issues that matter. And as leaders in our families and really trusted advisors in our community, our voices are making a difference every single day. And so as a YWCA, we are this year spearheading a year-long civic engagement campaign called Why Women Vote 2020, same as the report. And we are really lifting up issues. We're doing issue education. We are connecting women to the census to make sure that all women and their families are counted in that really important effort of our nation. We're investing in women's leadership development and in nonpartisan voter registration and mobilization. From our perspective, women's voices matter, and we want to do everything we can to make sure that our opinions are heard, our perspectives on the issues are taken into account by all, men, women, by not even through the binary, right, through anybody who is representing communities in elected office. We want them to know about this data so that they can make really well-informed choices for their communities.
That's quite a masterful threading of the needle, Catherine.
I don't know.
Catherine Bean is Vice President of Public Policy and Advocacy at YWCA USA, and we thank you so much for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you for your time. I enjoyed talking to you, Tom. Take care.
What are the challenges facing women in agriculture? What opportunities exist today that might not have only a generation ago? Well, for some answers to those questions, we're going to Nicholasville, the global headquarters of the animal nutrition, meat, brewing, and distilling company Alltech, and Alltech President and CEO Mark Lyons. Thanks for joining us, Dr. Lyons.
Yeah, great to be with you again.
So, Dr. Lyons, you did go searching for answers to those questions in the form of a survey that was taken in 2019. You went very far afield. How many people were surveyed, and how far abroad did you go with it?
Well, this, you know, Alltech being a global company, we have that opportunity to really go out and reach a very broad group of people. We had over 2,500 respondents, and we just kept this open for a month. Unsurprisingly, perhaps, and something that we've discussed for future surveys, we called this the Women in Food and Ag Survey, and we had 72% women respond. So we've thought about renaming this the Future of Work or something like that going forward so that we maybe balance that out a little bit. But, you know, a really good cross-section of countries, some of the usual suspects you might have guessed, U.S., Canada, U.K., Ireland, but then also a good representation from Latin America, Brazil and Mexico, good representation from Portugal and Spain, India. And so I think a lot of places where Alltech already has good representation and that we could make, you know, a good connection. So that was tremendous. The other piece, which maybe isn't so much around gender or geography, is really who was responding. So we had, you know, when you think about agriculture, you're really talking about some of the smallest, small landholders up to large scale companies. And we had 25% of the respondents coming from companies with over 3,000 employees. And then we had 39% with 1 to 50 employees. So I think a really good cross section there as well that's important.
Okay, let's take a look at what you found. Let's dig into some of the questions and then what you've learned from the responses that you received. And the first item is workplace perceptions. Perhaps not surprisingly, your findings show some pretty significant differences between the perceptions of men and women. What did you find?
Yeah, so I think, as you say, you would expect some difference. And I think this was probably as important for the men in the audience as the women. There's about a 20% difference in almost all of the categories in terms of what men felt and what women felt. So men, much 20% more likely to feel that there was equality within their organization. Men feeling that women are 20% more likely to say that women are fairly compensated, although that was interesting because only it was 41% of men versus 22% of women. So already a majority feeling that that's not the case. And I thought this one was quite a good question, actually, when it was posed. Have you ever been mistaken for someone at a lower level? 27% of men said that was true. Half of the women said that was true. So that's something that I think can really speak to the experience in the workplace. And this is all about putting ourselves in the shoes of others and then thinking, how does that change the way that we respond in terms of how we act in the workplace? So, you know, that difference, you know, not surprising, but very, you know, I think a real teachable moment for all of us and something that can be beneficial in bringing about change.
The survey also looked at barriers. Tell us about that. What was found in that area?
This one also is what we really want to get to. You know, having a baseline, having an understanding, mm-hmm. having some data is useful. But if we can't turn that into action, then it's not that helpful. And so really the big ones here, we've heard time and time again that one of the most important things for progressing in our careers is having mentors and having opportunities. And then those mentors opening up those opportunities. It might be as simple as making a connection, putting two people together for a cup of coffee, you know, giving that little bit of insight when you need it or a bit of support when you're having a tough day. And we found that there was a big difference in the ability for women to get mentors in significant positions. This is probably already because maybe there's not enough women in senior positions. But that's something that I think, you know, that's actionable and something we can do something about. There was also a feeling that, you know, 60% of men and women saying that they were not aware or they didn't believe that their company had an inclusion or diversity policy. And so I think that's an important point. That's something we can do something about. And this feeling around the pay gap, that there was this gap there in terms of compensation. And again, a lot of companies are stepping forward with this. They're doing things on a needs basis. And so I think that's an important aspect. I think for us, you know, it's all about access to things like education, to grants, making sure that, you know, as we see these barriers, we come up with mechanisms to break them down and help individuals have the greatest potential opportunities in their careers.
Okay. And the survey was also forward-looking. There's a section on hope for the future. What did you find in that area?
Well, the good news was that you know, the vast majority of people, 77% of women, in fact, said that they thought their organizations were becoming more inclusive. And so I think that that's really important, that people are feeling that there is a positive change. And that was something that was felt across both genders. We also felt, though, that there needed to be more better representation. And so I think all of this is opening up opportunities for us. Our mission here is really to make sure that we're empowering everybody for their greatest contribution. And we feel that our sector really needs that, where sometimes we're not attracting enough talent. This is generally a topic, particularly in industry discussions, not bringing enough young people. And so we think that these types of things are important to highlight so that we can bring in that top level talent that we need to continue to develop and create this planet of plenty.
What would you say are the most important lingering challenges that have been identified by this research?
So I think the biggest lingering challenge I think that comes from this is really, you know, can we build that top level buy-in? And what was great at the conference was we did have leaders from across industry, across geography there. I would actually say, and it's something we spoke about afterwards, was men were significantly underrepresented. And I think that we've got to make sure that we realize that this is a very important topic. If you are a CEO or if you're a leader in your company, you need to own these difficult issues, because it's hard for sometimes people at middle levels to have the big impact if they don't know that the top down is very supportive of them. So I think that that's one of the most important things. It needs to start with CEOs. And then from there, it can permeate, the message can really be picked up by everybody. And so the way that we can remove some of the biggest obstacles is just that, giving people a voice and making sure this is something that we're open to discussing.
And do you plan for this to be an annual survey?
Yeah, I think that we will move ahead with this on an annual basis. We're also pulling this into our one conference as part of a section on the future of work. I think this is a really interesting area. We can learn a lot from other industries. We can learn a lot from what's happening in different geographies. How are people thinking about the workplace? How are they thinking about their jobs? And of course, so much of what we see with people today is that they want to work for companies and with organizations that have a purpose. And so that's a big part of why, you know, we're promoting this topic and feel that this can be a really important part of the One Conference going forward.
Dr. Mark Lyons, he is president and CEO of Alltech. Thanks so much, Mark.
Thank you.
Next week on Eastern Standard, we talk with him just as the project was getting underway. Now, Nathan Vandeford, director of the Appalachian Career Training in Oncology Program at Markey Cancer Center, is back to tell us about a forthcoming book of essays by young Appalachians who are stepping up to tackle a terrible scourge in their hometowns of eastern Kentucky.
We rank number one in overall cancer incidence and mortality rates. That problem is greatest in eastern Kentucky. And so this represents thousands of people who contract and pass away from cancer every year. And that data is powerful. But behind all those numbers are people.
Nathan Vandeford, here to tell us about the essays of aspiring future oncologists of Eastern Kentucky. That wraps this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions with the support of the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky, an accredited community foundation, and their Appalachian Impact Fund. Our executive producer is Mike Savage. Neil Kesterson is our producing engineer and audio editor. You can listen to editions of Eastern Standard online at weku.org or esweku.org, on the WEKU mobile app, or as a podcast on NPR One, iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. We'd like to hear from you. You can email us at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.